Well, good evening. So tonight I'd like to continue this little series on the different gateways into the Dharma. And what I really mean by this is almost like the hidden gateways, things that we don't usually think of as pathways into the Dharma, things that we actually look at usually as an obstacle, something that gets in the way of our spiritual practice. Barriers. So we've talked about the worry mind. We talked about the election, the wanting mind. And tonight we're going to talk about the busy mind. So these things that, we don't usually think of as parts of our spiritual practice, but learning to use them actually as a gateway into our practice could be very profound, help us to really connect with our daily lives into our spirituality. So tonight, the busy mind. So hopefully this is timely as we enter the holiday season. You know, even if you don't celebrate Christmas, there's still this kind of sea that we swim in of frenetic energy, of holiday music, of frantic shoppers. So it's hard to not be affected. And often we do partake of that. We find ourselves having to do extra parties, extra preparation. So what is this busyness? So certainly we often think of ourselves as being too busy. You know, there's this fast pace of our lives that we have so many things that we've overcommitted to do. It often becomes the very way that we approach life, that we just keep stacking on more and more things. But it also has more of a subtle quality, that even when we're sitting meditating, how often is our mind very busy, you know, with the commentary, the thoughts about the future, about the past, about the present. It's a constant stream of thinking that can often go through, that we can also consider as part of this expression of busyness. Even gets more subtle as we look at the sense of commentator, the sense of you weighing in on your experience, noticing, okay, I like that breath, or I don't like that breath, I like that sound. Even more subtle, just the sense of knowing something, the sense of labeling something as being this person, a chair, an object. That's still a sense of removal from this base experience of stillness. The stillness, which is this matrix that we always are arising from and fading back into. And so we spend much of our time in this process of busyness, whether it's with our thinking, with our activities, with our mental elaboration. So naturally, the winter time is a quiet time. We naturally become more still as we approach the solstice, the longest night. And with that stillness, with the deepening of the darkness, we naturally tend to turn more inward. So we have this natural movement inward, natural quieting, natural simplification that comes out this time of year. Contrast that with the energy and frenetic energy of the holidays. And if you go into a shopping center, into a mall, you can just feel things swirling around. People trying to cut in front of you to get that, whatever they're trying to get. So it's really palpable in the air. So the holiday season almost brings forth this underlying current, which is in some ways always present in our lives, in our society, this sense of busyness, this sense of urgency. It's almost an essential character of our culture. Sometimes I tell people, they ask me how I'm doing, I'm saying I'm busy. And inside I'm thinking I'm too busy and I need to back off. And they say, oh good, I'm glad that you're busy. It's this value that we carry, that we should be very busy. Remember in high school, at one point I was overcommitted with school and with sports and trying to cram one more thing in, and I just saw myself realizing I'm getting trained to be busy. You know, this sense of moving from the more relaxed leisureness of a child to being initiated into this adult world of overcommitment and busyness. And I was kind of dismayed to see that, to realize that. Now, busyness is often, we often think of it as this person's, we're doing so many things. is actually independent of activity, of action. That we can be sitting still and be very busy, you know, thinking, planning things out, worrying about what's going to happen, or fantasizing. At the same time, we can be very active, but still come from a place of stillness. That stillness can still be the ground that we move from. So try to explore some of this tonight. And there's three main explorations for this talk tonight. One is how the busy mind, when we really engage in that, is actually an expression of our ignorance, of our sense of not knowing how things really are. The second one is engaging in the busy mind is reinforcing our ignorance. So not only is it an expression of our ignorance, it's also reinforcing that. And finally, what do we have to give up to be able to release busyness, to actually let it fade from our lives? So this first aspect, how the busy mind is an expression of our ignorance. Now, I want to take a moment to unpack this word ignorance, because often we think of it with certain connotations, just not knowing something, you know, being kind of ignorant of a particular way of being in the world. It's better to think of it more as a sense of blindness, a sense of not seeing how things are. So it's actually there's a more technical aspect of it from Buddhist thought. Actually, in the dependent origination, is often portrayed as a blind person, not just being able to see the world through sight. And from that place of blindness, then ignorance leads to more and more suffering. And sometimes it takes beyond just a sense of not seeing to a more almost aggressive seeing and acting opposite to how things are. So specifically, this sense of ignorance focuses around these three characteristics of existence. Three characteristics that everything in the practice and teachings revolve around these three aspects. And so the more we clearly see them, the more we directly align our lives with them, the less suffering we have, the more freedom we have. And they can be very interrelated with each other. So impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. Impermanence, non-satisfactoriness, and non-self. So since impermanence, everything is in flux, everything is in a process of changing. There's nothing that we can point to, physical, mental, emotional, that is always constant. You know, everything is in a process of evolving, of decaying, of growing. And because of that, there's a quality of unsatisfactoriness. We often want the certain mind state, the certain emotion to keep lasting, the sense of physical health to last forever. But impermanence means that that will always be changing, that will not last forever. And impermanence also takes the effect on this sense of who we take ourselves to be, the sense of self. We often have this assumption that there's a sense of me going through the world. But if we look closely, if we really look closely, we see that there's a sense of self that's always arising to each moment and fading away. If we look closely, we see that there's many selves that give birth in each day and many selves, senses of self, that fall away in each day. Now, if we don't see these three characteristics, we're acting from ignorance. We're living in ignorance. And with that particular view, our actions, our thoughts, how we live the life, this life flow from this lack of understanding. We try to hold on to something that's changing. We try to invest in this sense of identity, who I am, even though that can change in the moment with the right comment, the right experience. We suddenly shift from someone who's competent and knows everything to someone who feels so much doubt. The sense of self has changed. And we suffer as a result. So how is this busy mind an expression of this ignorance? So again, including all aspects of ignorance, from both the rumination, the sense of thinking, overthinking things, to the subtle qualities, to the kind of frenzy, trying to juggle all these balls at once. So as you reflect on this quality of busyness, however it shows up for you, how often is that engaged when we're trying to prevent things from changing? We want something not to change, and there's a constant trying to tweak it, to try to force it to go something different. I remember when my daughter was in preschool, I often use this example. We went to this beach to play. So the kids were, you know, preschool age, and so they make some sandcastles. But the tide's coming in. So there's all this frenetic energy trying to build up the walls, to put down these dikes to keep the tide from coming in. Right? But yet the tide kept coming in until finally the sandcastles collapsed. And so when impermanence is, we're not really seeing that's the nature of things, we're like those kids always rebuilding those sand walls, trying to build more dikes, even though it's inevitable that the tide will come in. And so if you deeply see this quality of impermanence, there's an aspect of busyness that falls away, that we simply rest in this sense of change, this sense of arising and passing away. We actually allow ourselves to rest in that, arising and passing away. So there's less of a need to be influencing, to be controlling. We realize, okay, influence when I can, but I realize that things will always change. So what about busyness in relationship to this quality of unsatisfactoriness or of dukkha? Yeah, how much of our busyness is trying to fix, to change, to give void, to improve this quality of unsatisfactoriness? The room is too cold, the room is too hot, and there's a sense of always moving around. It was interesting when I used to do some managing for retreats, you know, here at Sims and down at Cloud Mountain. And inevitably you get these yogi notes that would say, okay, the room is too hot, or the room is too cold. And because I was in the context of being on retreat, I gave myself permission not to have to act right away on those, to actually see the note, see the urgency of the note, and be able to be with it, to see my reaction. And that helped to start to unhook the busyness. There's other times when I've managed things here and we forgot tea or something, so I run off during a break and try to find tea. And there's that frenetic energy that takes over. You know, that sense of unsatisfactoriness, that things will not quite be right for every person. And no matter how perfect it is, it will always change. So often we're so busy trying to fix and overcome this quality of unsatisfactoriness, we just lack that simple acknowledgement that this is how life is. That life sometimes is pleasant, sometimes unpleasant. Sometimes it's something that you want to last and doesn't. Sometimes something you don't want to last continues. Like driving in traffic. I spent an hour and 20 minutes driving here, so I was wanting that traffic to end. But there's a sense of things aren't the way I want them to be. So relaxing into that, then the mind can be more still, more quiet in the midst of that. And at Christmas time, sometimes there's this sense of unfulfilled hope, or if we give the right present or receive the right present, then finally I'll be happy. Even though deep down we know that's not true. But still, maybe this year we get it right. So that sense of fighting or arguing with this quality of unsatisfactoriness. So what about busyness in relationship to non-self? And notice when saying non-self instead of not self or no self. Because it's true that there is a sense of self that arises. We have a sense of embodiment into it. But it's inherently empty. It's inherently subject to change. It's always in flux, always changing. It's very unstable if you look carefully at it. When I say not self, there's a sense of denying that reality. But saying non-self helps us to really see that it arises, but it's empty in that arising. Now, this quality of non-self, because it's so fragile, we're constantly having to recreate it. It creates tremendous busyness in our lives. Because this is often the sense of wanting to uphold a sense of identity. I'm a competent person. I'm a reliable person. I want someone's approval. I don't want to get someone's disapproval. And that drives so much of our busyness, our doing, constantly doing. We're constantly having to prove it over and over again. If that sense of self was so stable, it would be just like, you know, nothing would shake that. We would just know that's how things are. So many of our choices around busyness are trying to reinforce this persistent self, sense of self, trying to maintain it. So this is this first section of the talk, that we are constantly expressing ignorance through our actions, through our busyness. If we really get a sense of that, it's through not understanding these three characteristics that busyness keeps coming out in many ways. So now going on to how engaging the busy mind is actually a way of reinforcing our ignorance. Engaging in the busy mind is a way of reinforcing this quality of ignorance. So this part is a bit more complex. So just if you can walk with me on the talk, because you can see how there's a weaving together of many factors that create this reinforcing or committing to these qualities of busyness. I'm using busyness just as an example, as a handle, but we can interpose many different qualities. We can impose worry, we can fear, grief. And if you get a sense of how we reinforce it, at least for myself, it gives a sense of urgency to my practice. Because I realize that right how I meet this moment sets up the next moment, the next days, the next years. So there's an urgency to really pay attention to how this moment is arising. How am I meeting this sense of busyness instead of becoming caught in it, instead of buying into it? I also start to see how busyness is really conditioned, is really created by our past history, our past conditioning, our past actions, really our past ignorance. It sets the stage for the present moment arising of busyness and the future arising. And seeing how we relate to this moment of busyness then sets the stage for arising in the future. So to do this, I'd like to talk more about the cycle of dependent origination. So this is a complex cycle of 12 links, which is more than to give you tonight. But we can give the outline of it, the framing of it. Because these 12 links are some of the critical ways of understanding how we create the sense of self moment after moment, and how that creation of sense of self leads to suffering. It's one of the key things of the Buddhist teachings, to understand and to really internalize and to act from. So these 12 links take us from this quality of ignorance. Again, ignorance is not understanding these three aspects of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, of non-self. So going from ignorance to how do we form a sense of self, and it then decays and eventually dies and creates even more suffering, and from there, more ignorance. So it's this kind of perpetual motion machine. It keeps going back over and over again. So from a quality of ignorance, from that sense of blindness, we have the momentum of our past choices, our past history, our past ways that we have related to our experience. These two qualities then condition how we actually perceive the moment, how it shapes how we see things, how actually we hear things, how we see things, smell things, how we label it, how we connect it with our past history. So it predisposes our sense gates to really perceive life in a certain way. That certain way is based on our past ignorance. So it's how we make meaning of this raw sense data is really shaped and controlled from our past history. that from the point of contact, from the sense data, hearing, smelling, tasting, seeing, thinking, we experience something as pleasant, as unpleasant, or as neither of those. Then from there, we have this movement toward it or away from it. And then from that point on, we create this sense of self. That sense of self may last for a while, may be enjoying this quality of pleasantness, may be not enjoying this quality of unpleasantness, but eventually that will fade, will pass away, and creates a whole new sense of suffering as that fades and dies, reinforces the ignorance, and the whole cycle continues. Setting up the next cycle. So we can look at this model of dependent origination as past causes, present results, present causes, and future results. So this is something I find very interesting and very exciting, but I know it might be a bit of a stretch. So I want to draw upon the great teacher of Charles Dickens with A Christmas Carol to help us illustrate and understand how this dependent origination really makes sense when we look at how if our past influences our present and our present influences our future. And it also helps with the holiday spirit. So The Christmas Carol, I'm sure everyone's very familiar with it. You have the ghosts of Christmas past, of Christmas present, and Christmas future, that these spirits would visit him in his kind of moment of crisis, of kind of coming to this coming to really examine himself and helping him examine how he's lived his life in the past, how he's currently living in it, and the consequences of that in the future. And we can see through working with this how the past causes can lead to the present results, and how the present causes lead to the future results. So the first ghost, the ghost that visited Ebenezer Scrooge. So the ghost of Christmas past comes. He starts to review his life. He reviews all the different choices he made, you know, choosing to go to business instead of going for love, choosing to develop, really focus on making money, and how those choices start to slowly change and shape his character. These are like the past volitional aspects, actions that are directed by his ignorance. Through how he understood life, he made certain choices that started to shape how he saw things. The volitional aspects actually changed how he would perceive life. Remember, as he would see the Christmas carolers, that changed how he was actually seeing. He saw that as unpleasant. You know, he yelled at them and threatened them. When the person came to ask for a donation, how he turned them away, how he treated his clerk, Bob Cratchit. So this past history, and we think about our own history with busyness, all the times that you've been overcommitted, overscheduled, that sense of just not quite doing enough. And even when you're in that state, you take on more. You know you should say yes, but you say, you should say no. You know you should say no, but you say yes. Add on yet another thing to reinforce how competent I am. Or perhaps just trying to help out, to try to be a caretaker. So all those choices start to shape how we are in the present moment. So just like Ebenezer, his past experiences, his past choices shaped how he was in the present moment. Remember the moment, the time when his deceased partner Marley shows up and shows him the long chains that he's carrying. And he says that you've labored even longer these last 7 years and carry even more chains. These chains are the momentum of our ignorance, the momentum of our past history, our past conditioning, really the karma, our actions, and how those actions create a certain weight that we carry into the present moment and shape how we perceive life. So this is the sense of the past causes from dependent origination. then you just go into the ghost of Christmas present. So these past causes then predispose us to see life in a certain way. It's kind of hard to really appreciate that. But just as any sound that we could put into the room, any word, some of us will have a pleasant connection with that, some will have an unpleasant connection with that. So why is that? I mean, some people in this room feel it's the perfect temperature. Some feel it's too hot, some too cold. Right? There's different conditions that predispose us to perceiving life in a certain way. We often think of things as being certain. There's like an absoluteness of sound, an absoluteness of sight. But it's actually very much interpreted through our own history. Right? So this is the key link to start to see. Our past ways that we've met each moment conditions us to meeting this moment in a certain way. Predisposes how we're going to actually perceive it and actually experience it. So just with Scrooge, when he heard the carolers, you know, it was very unpleasant for him. When he heard the word Christmas, everyone around him is having such a great sense with that word. And him, it was just bah humbug. He's seeing life very differently. And so from the perspective of with the spirit of Christmas present, he's able to see how his actions are really perceived and how his actions affect those around him, those he has to care for, like Cratchit's family. So can we see this effect of busyness in our own lives? I mean, sometimes when I get so busy, I just reflect on the impact on my family, on my wife and my daughter, and how it takes me away from being able to be present from them, that sense of overcommitment, the sense of an impact on my own health, my own sense of well-being. So that sense of seeing the impact of this moment. How in this time of year when we get so caught up in busyness, how often are we rude or inconsiderate of strangers? We're just so overcommitted, so going so fast that we don't take the time to be considerate, to actually connect with another person. So from here we see the present results of our past causes. And also at the same time, we're laying down the groundwork for the present cause, or the future cause, I should say. So going to the ghost of Christmas future. So now we're starting to see, as Ebenezer goes through the story, he's looking at his life into the future, the potential life, and seeing himself dying alone and unloved, unacknowledged, hated even, people having no regard for him, seeing the effects on Cratchit's family, on poor Tiny Tim. Same thing with us, seeing the future busyness, how that creates our present busyness creates the circumstances for the future. So I hope you're starting to get the sense of this, that how we meet the moment is very critical. The moment's almost preloaded how we're going to perceive the moment. So you're sitting there minding your own business, meditating, and some sound comes in, and there's a sense of irritation that arises with that sound. Okay, another person might hear that sound as pleasant. Right? So we have a certain relationship to it based on our kind of preloading, our preconditioning. Right? But from that moment of unpleasantness or pleasantness, that's a critical moment. So often we go into, why is that darn light rail going by again? Can't they stop it during our sitting and you know, why is someone coming in late? And, you know, why is that person coughing? And we just kind of go on and on. That's going from the moment of contact. That's, again, we're perceiving it as unpleasant and going into a quality of birthing into an unpleasant state of being. I'm going to put a note in their suggestion box. And, you know, there's all this action that comes up from that point of becoming. So the key thing is at that point we have a choice. Where do we put our energy? We find ourselves being in an unpleasant experience, a sense of busyness. Can we, for a moment, come back into the body to feel our sense of our body sitting, feeling our breath, feeling sound, hearing sound? connecting, affirming this quality of stillness instead of the busyness. Or we have the choice of reaffirming the busyness, to acting on it, thinking about it, acting from it, speaking around it, creating more and more busyness, which then predisposes our sense gates to become more reactive. This is a very critical thing to understand. My wife sent me this article. It's entitled, "Self-Control is Just Empathy for Your Future Self." Okay? Self-control is empathy for your future self. And the article talked about from the Atlantic that there's a part of our brain, the temporal parietal lobe, the same place that allows us to have self-control also allows us to have empathy. So those are very linked. And we have a sense of empathy. We really put ourselves in someone else's shoes. That also is the same part that allows us to have this quality of restraint, of self-will. So I'm hoping by starting to see, just like Ebenezer saw, the consequences of how he acts do matter. We see how we act with these qualities of busyness, of worry, of the election, of any difficult mind state, any of the hindrances. How we meet it is very critical. If we're able to see a sense of self-compassion, a sense of empathy for ourselves, we'll be able to relate to that moment a little differently. And starting to understand the cost of expressing and acting on our ignorance. It reaffirms that ignorance. So this can help set this intention. But this is actually where it gets hard. You know, if we have the intentionality, when we see how this isn't working for us, the hard part is actually to give up what busyness gives us. So this is the third part of the talk. You know, what do we have to give up to release busyness? Because if it was completely bad, we wouldn't do it. Right? If something's completely noxious to our system, we don't keep picking it up. So this present moment, this tendency of being busy, of being over-engaged, again, it's kind of pre-programmed, the tendency toward it. It's like we have a fertile seed of busyness. And if the conditions are right, that seed will sprout and grow into a plant. So there's this constant state of conditions. There's our society, our culture, that's saying, yeah, you should be more busy. You should work harder, do more. But how much we invest into that seed is optional. We have this choice. So again, it comes down to how do we meet this moment? One of the most difficult things to give up around busyness is our self-identity that's tied with that. Right? You know, for myself, often when I'm in a group, I'm one of the people that's seeing what needs to be done, I'm doing it. And I kind of do that almost compulsively, you know, doing more than my share. So it's really hard for me to see something that the trash needs to be emptied or something needs to be taken out and not act on that. And at the same time, there's a little bit of resentment that's building up. But there's that whole sense of self that's created and formed around that very action. And so for me to release that quality of busyness is really about me releasing that identity with that quality of being competent and being self-righteous. So that sense of busyness may be a sense of need for approval. You know, if I do enough, someone will approve of me. The desire for a certain outcome that we so often drives this quality, a sense of control. These are all aspects of self-identity that really are tied into why busyness continues to go on in our life. Right? So by learning how to connect into the actual state of busyness instead of the urge to act from it, you know, again, coming into how does the busyness feel in the body instead of the need to act what I want to do about it. I can start to become still with it. I can start to see these much deeper qualities of identity that are connected with it. And I can see, okay, there's a choice of letting go of this identity. Is identity worth letting go of? So we start to see these identities, we see them, we understand them, and then they can be released. So this is a movement from ignorance toward wisdom. Remember the three characteristics, the characteristic of non-self? So busyness shows us this quality of identity, how we believe in a certain quality of self. Another aspect is this fear of stillness. I think this is one of the deepest ones, even perhaps more deep than self-identity. Because if we're not busy in doing, if we're just simply still with ourselves, what arises? Often there may be a backlog of grief, of sadness, of loss. There's a pain that needs to be acknowledged and be open to. And instead of feeling that, it's much easier to be caught in busyness. You may have seen this in your meditative practice as you're sitting and you get lost in thought and the elaboration of whatever that might be. And you wake up to that and you come back to the body and you find that there's pain there. There's physical pain. So developing this capacity, increasing our capacity to hold the difficult, to be with the difficult, allows us to really deepen into our practice. Because if we're always moving away from pain, we go into patterns like busyness. This applies also to emotional pain, the willingness to just be soft with that, to open to that, instead of being so distracted. And sometimes you get a sense of that when you're seeing someone who's so busy. It's like they're trying to stay away from this deeper underlying angst of unrest. That all it calls for is a simple acknowledgement, a simple meeting. So it's vital that we're building our capacity slowly over time to hold what is unpleasant, what is difficult in this moment. Just seeing the stillness even in that. And also that our practice is oriented toward understanding. That we practice in order to see clearly, to see deeply, to see these three characteristics, as opposed to our practice oriented around acquiring, of gaining states, experiences, gaining enlightenment, however we may conceive of that. The sense of wanting to understand so clearly and so deeply, combined with this capacity to hold the difficult, allows our practice to really settle and to deepen. Because the difficult isn't, we often our resistance to the difficult is really magnifies it, makes it so much more intense than the actual experience of it. And once we're able to accommodate that and open to it, then difficulties arise, but it's held with this context of stillness, of openness. At the same time, within that ability to open to the difficult, we also learn to open to the joy, the deep peace of being connected to the moment. And the stillness is simply, it's like waking up from a dream, that you've been lost in this dream, and you suddenly wake up and realize where you are, what the surroundings are around you. So this time of the year, it was a natural inclination towards stillness. So giving yourself time to connect with that, to not buy into the need to be busy. You can still be moving very quickly, but there's an inner stillness that's always accessible because that's the bedrock, that's the substance that we arise from. We just forget that. We can lose that track of that. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And even in this moment of stillness, of quiet, notice how this is always accessible. It's always present. We may become distracted and lose contact with it, but it's always available. And the more we orient ourselves toward that stillness, the more we can recognize it in all experiences, in all situations. So we have some time for any comments or questions. I had some homework for you, but I was too busy and rushed to print it off. So I would like to just share that now with you, or for you. So we're actually trying to change the word from homework to something like practice and reflection. These are ways to really integrate the talk subject into your daily life. Right, to see, take it from something that you're just hearing to actually, how do you embody it? How do you walk with that? So the practice is to go to a shopping mall, shopping center, and practice being still. Practice being still. So you might go there without a need to buy anything or actually do anything, but it's just to kind of immerse yourself into that environment. Like you're going into the middle of a tempest. You just, what does it feel like to be in the middle of this, hearing this wind and this rain hitting me? Can I be in the middle of that and still find a quality of stillness? The body is going to be a good guide for you. You know, feeling the body sitting, feeling the sense of the breath, very simply. So in the midst of all this, can you still connect with that stillness? Can you let the swirl of activity and energy be seen from a place of stillness instead of engaging with the frenetic energy? And start to see that it's a choice to become lost in busyness or to move from within stillness. And then if you have to do some shopping, to see, can I move from that sense of stillness, building in these many pauses, these touch points into stillness, even in the midst of this whole swirl of busyness around you. Then the reflection. This next time that you're feeling busy, ask yourself, what would I feel if I wasn't busy being busy? What would I feel if I wasn't busy being busy? So as you ask that question, just tune in and just, it's like you're holding that, a koan that you can't answer immediately, but just holding that question and seeing what emerges, and what emerges under that and under that. Perhaps a sense of sadness, a sense of fatigue. And just being curious with yourself. We'll put this homework on the website. So are there any questions or comments out there? It's Moffat.
It seems like part of the problem of being busy is maybe that it's like when I'm busy doing something, I'm happy doing it, but if I'm feeling busy, it's because I should be doing something later, or it's like a future,
right.
A future state of mind is the busy mind, but the activity doesn't feel like it has to be that compromised.
Yeah, so the comment is on how we can be active doing something, really externally looking busy, but internally not feeling that sense of having to do all these things down in the to-do list that keeps growing, or that sense of mental, emotional busyness. And yeah, I think those can be very separate. There can be a sense of being very engaged and very active. But it's really this mental and emotional component that I'm trying to speak toward tonight. Because I think that's the aspect that really ties us back into this pattern of suffering, into the process of selfing, the process of ignorance being reaffirmed and resetting the stage. So it's that kind of quality that you just feel like you just can't get off the rat's, the wheel. You just keep going over and over again. Yeah, so it's really important to see that, to notice that. And when do you start to shift over, or when can you release that in the middle of that? Christina Feldman one year came and said that she had renounced being in a hurry. But she said, it doesn't mean I don't move quickly at times. Right? So that sense of being in a hurry, it's like that, like I'm trying to move myself faster than my body is. I'm trying to move into the future. I'm trying to do all these things I can't do right now. Versus that sense of really connecting with where I am in this moment. And yeah, I may be very active in this moment. Maybe, you know, doing something very quickly, seemingly busy, but there's a stillness inside. Yeah, so I think it's a very interesting thing. There's a famous story of a busy person in the suttas. So Agulimala. So he was very busy as a serial killer. He had been set on, is actually a very, if you read the commentary about it, he was born kind of under a bad star that kind of predicted he would really be a bad person, a violent person, cause a lot of danger in his life. So his parents wanted to really avoid that. So they put him into this really good school and got a good teacher. And he really was not going down that path. And he was the top student, the student's pet. But his fellow students got resentful of that. And so they actually kind of conspired against him by telling the teacher, you know, this guy, he's talking bad about you. And different students would do that. So the teacher actually started to see Agulimala as not a good person. And so at the end, after the training, he needed to get his endorsement from the teacher. And the teacher said, well, you have to give me a gift before I endorse you. And that gift shall be 1,000 human fingers. Okay? 1,000 human fingers. So, you know, there's a lot of distortion going on. But that was enough because of his predisposition, his past conditioning, that set him on this path of becoming a mass murderer. So he had 999 fingers. He needed one more. Right? And he was, okay, and his mom was actually walking around. And he's like, okay, I don't care that she's my mom. I'm going to kill her and take her fingers. But the Buddha saw that and perceived that and actually went in place of the mom. And so there's this really, it's really interesting sutta that Agulimala, who's incredibly strong, is able to overcome all these soldiers and superhuman strength. The Buddha's just walking along and Agulimala's running as fast as he can to try to catch up with them, and he can't catch them. And so finally he says, you know, monks, stop. And the Buddha turns and says, I have stopped. It is you who have not stopped. So in the midst of movement, there's still a deep stillness. Or in the midst of lots of movement, there's a tremendous turmoil, a tremendous sense of unrest. And so in that moment, Agulimala changed everything. It's like Scrooge, it's like he saw, and he dropped his ways and actually ordained and fairly quickly became an arhat through his sincerity. So that's the beautiful thing about, as soon as we really see things clearly, there is this ability to let it go, to drop it. Even now Agulimala is like the patron saint of women in labor, because he's considered this protector. That's how much he transformed himself from a serial killer to someone that women who are in labor would pray to. What else is out there? Yes.
Can you speak a little further about how to hold your peace when the environment around you or others around you and your environment are very frenetic and stressed and sometimes having to empathize or take on their behavior?
Yeah. So the question is how do you actually come into that sense of inner stillness or inner peace when the people around you are really caught up in the busyness and the urgency to act? And how do you actually do that when there's such an invitation to join them, to be caught in it? So for myself, it's very helpful. You know, again, I learned this when I was a retreat manager, is to give a pause, to kind of create a separation from the urge to act and the actual action. Because if we're having the urge to act and we're acting, we're caught in that whole process and there's no space. Because really the urge to act, you know, there's this whole stuff that happens before, the predisposition of the sense gates, the sense of pleasant or unpleasant, and the urge to act is like we're just, you know, want to get into it. We won't take birth into that form. But if we can take a moment to just pause and say, okay, I'm not going to act right now. I'll get back to you, or I'm going to go to the bathroom, or whatever it might be. I can make up something. Then that pause, okay, what's present in this moment? I mean, it's a beautiful way to start a meditation. It's, okay, what's present in this experience? You know, is there fatigue? Is there a sense of stillness, sense of busy mind? And so in that midst of urgency to act, you really see, okay, how is the heart rate going? How is the sense of tension in the body? What's the thoughts that are coming up to that? What's the self-identity that's coming there? What's the sense of, belief around that? Asking that question, what would I be feeling if I wasn't having that urge to act? And then it starts to really highlight, oh, I have to act not so much to do this thing, but because I don't want to get blamed, or I want to make sure I get my share, or whatever it might be, so I can be part of the gang. So it's difficult, because I didn't talk about this in this talk, but when we're caught in busyness, or we could say stress, there's this whole cascade of hormones which is going through our system. And we can we do that chronically, we're exhausted, but we almost need that new burst of adrenaline, of cortisol, to kick us up, to wake us up. So that's one of the almost a chemical addiction to being busy, to being stressful. So it actually takes a lot of fortitude, but maybe thinking about that sense of future self-compassion, empathy for your future self, that connecting with myself in this simple way will help to change it. And it's interesting, too, that when things are really urgent, when things really have to happen, sometimes the one person who steps back and kind of looks at the whole situation sees what's the right thing to do. Like in a first aid situation, an emergency situation. I mean, what do they don't, train you to just run blindly into the person. You stop back and say, okay, what's the dangers? What, is that person electrocuted or something else? That's that pause. They can still be still, even in the midst of needing to be urgent. So it's really the practicing. Practice in small ways that don't have so much charge and that can translate into the much bigger ones. Just let me get her first and then we'll get to you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like I feel like my days off, I have a lot more emotional angst.
Yeah.
But I don't have something to put my attention to, and it's not like primary care, so it's not like super down like ER, but it's just like something to focus my attention on versus sort of like an unstructured day. I feel like I have a lot more internal turmoil.
Right. Yes, yeah, so the comment is because of her work and in healthcare that when there's crises coming up, she's able to actually be very calm and centered. But it's more like when she's off work that there's much more turmoil and worry or busyness going through the system. Yeah, that's a really good point because often we can train ourselves. Like my parents are physicians, so it's interesting when there's something bad happening, they're just like, they go into the doctor mode and they're just like, calm and cool. But it's also, there's a sense of identity that's formed around that. And so when you don't have that identity to rest upon, that training, the things are much more kind of unstructured. So in those moments of feeling that, see if you can in the moment come back into the body, just okay, there might be an urge to act, including thinking about it, elaborating on it, and see if I can connect more simply with how the body is in this moment. And asking that simple question, what am I really feeling in this moment? What am I really experiencing? Feeling that very completely, the body, emotionality, and thoughts. feeling without the need to change it or do anything with it, but simply notice it. And in that noticing, you have to trust that by really noticing and seeing it, that's the transformation that happens. And you start to see, oh, wow, there's this deep sense of perhaps if I'm not, you know, being of service, if I'm not doing something, what worth am I? You know, I'm just, as one example. And so can I be of worth when I'm being useless? Can I be of worth when I'm not doing anything but being still? So it's an exploration. That's what's beautiful about these gateways, is that they show you, if you look in the right way, it's the perfect spiritual path for you. It shows you exactly where you identify, where you get stuck. Instead of fighting it and trying to get rid of it, if you're really open to it, it really accelerates your practice. Thank you. Yeah, Reggie. Yeah. So the comment is, you know, times when you're like caretaking someone and there's a sense of, do you just get to the point where you're hungry, you're tired, you're just stretched too much, it just goes on and you're just exhausted. And at that point, it's really hard to be skillful. You're kind of caught in it and it just builds upon it. And that's really the part about the whole cycle of dependent origination, is like the past conditions have set up how we perceive the moment. You know, we've been here for, you know, weeks on end, months on end, years on end, you know, we're exhausted, we haven't slept, we haven't eaten. Those conditions set us up to have a certain relationship to the moment's experience. All right, so how we meet that, I mean, it's you know, times when you're calm, you can think about, okay, I need a problem, you know, there's very practical parts too. I need a problem solve, I need to bring snacks for myself. I need to find some way to have some kind of respite, some kind of break in the midst of that. Not go more than 5 hours without at least a walk around the block or something like that. And how so you have to kind of problem solve that. And there's times when you can't, right? There's times when you are the one who's responsible for taking care of this, whether it's an older person or a young child, it's like you have to be there. There's just no other choice. So then there's that, you know, then there's deeper reserves that start to come up and start to play with that. Even observing how overwhelmed you are, even observing how hungry and tired you are, is enough to start to change it, right? If we're caught in it or not observing it, we're just reinforcing that pattern over and over again. But if we're able to be in the middle of that and still observe that, it's like, well, I am just so cranky right now. I just want to bite this person's heads off. You know, I noticed that. And yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, there's many, many reasons for busyness and urgency that we can't avoid. But there's also many that we can. Yes. Hi, Sasha.
In relation to the idea of busyness being a gateway to the Dharma, and also you talk about anxiety being a gateway to the Dharma, and I guess in relation to my own practice, I experienced the value of that and staying with it, but I was wondering if sometimes
mm-hmm.
I feel like you mentioned something that was along the lines of almost like an addictive
Sure. So is there other ways to work with it when it's, you know, especially around anxiety or worry, you know, when it gets so, other skillful ways other than just being with it? I think it's really important to realize that sometimes it's too much to really open to. It's like our mindfulness can get kind of colored or shaped by the state itself. Like, let's say there's a lot of anxiety. It's like, so we start to look at that, but the way we're looking at it is actually looking at it from the anxiety itself. And so then we get more anxious about how anxious we are, and it just builds and builds and builds. So in those cases, it's good to kind of check in to see, how is my attention? How is my quality of mind? My sense of mindfulness? Like the last question, if mind is just cranky and brittle and hard, it's not so productive to trying to be doing, you know, still investigation. So shifting to a different object of awareness, like a sense of distraction, like I'm going to intentionally move away from this fireball of worry, of anxiety, is something that my attention can naturally land on, can soften around. So maybe just open your eyes and seeing the beauty of nature, you know, hearing a sound, feeling a part of the body that's comfortable, till the mindfulness starts to become more pliable, more soft. Because otherwise there's that tendency for it to kind of implode. You know, sometimes doing something like metta can be very helpful. Like I told this story, I think a few weeks ago. There was a time when my wife was in the hospital, and it was a very, you know, urgent situation. And I was trying to be a good meditator and connect with my body and my breath. And I was like trying to drop water on a hot skillet. It would just all over the place because it couldn't penetrate. Looking back, I realized the state of that fear of what would happen, what might happen, was really shaping how I could see. I could just could not make any headway on that. So instead of like trying to force that, you know, when you feel there's a lot of tension, that's usually going the wrong way. Sometimes there's a sense of tension that we're trying to open to, but we feel like we're also, our relaxation's balanced it. When the tension becomes overwhelming, then it's time to shift. So in that instance, I shifted to metta, to loving kindness. So in other words, intentionality, you know, may I feel some safety here? May I be happy? May I be healthy? May she be safe? And so that can be a very helpful thing to do too, because the intentionality, sometimes it's like shifting onto a whole different paradigm of how to relate to this experience. And then when times when the mind is more pliable for whatever reason, then you can start to bring in that sense of anxiety or worry. Ideally, we practice when it's easy, when it's doable. And when we're already spent, we're already over consumed by the state, it's like we have to shift to something else. And same thing with being worn out from caretaking. Same thing with physical pain. It's, you know, the analogous of how do we shift our attention so our mindfulness is more pliable. Okay. All right, thank you for your kind attention.